Thank you, Eileen. That was an introduction that's difficult to deal with as a speaker. I want to say I'm extremely pleased that so many people find the general theme of this program, science, religion, and the human experience, interesting enough to show up for this first presentation. I'm extremely sorry that not everybody could find a seat. And I've talked with Jim about this. And are we OK on that understanding? OK. So the lecture will be videotaped. And the videotape will be shown in a second showing that will be announced in the regular way as a UCSB event. So people who could not come into the room and who are not comfortable outside, I hope some are still there and can hear me, do have that option. When I was a 15-year-old high school student in Vienna, I was required to make a short presentation to my class. It was the only time that happened. I chose the Galileo story as my subject. Today, more than 60 years later, the Italian National Telescope is named Galileo, and I am, for the second time in my life, making a presentation on science and religion. Certainly, science, especially physics and chemistry, is a very important part of my identity. But I also consider myself a religious person, and in two senses. One, based on my liberal Jewish upbringing, which I have passed on to my children. The other, a kind of non-denominational deism, which springs from my awe of the world of our experiences and is heightened by my identity as a scientist. It also includes a conviction that science alone is an insufficient guide through life, leaving many deep questions unanswered and needs unfulfilled. Based on my reading of history, and especially my personal experience, I feel passionate about mutual tolerance and respect between different religions, as well as agnosticism and atheism. Among contemporary religious leaders, the one I most admire is the Dalai Lama. Today, I shall try and present to you a case history in which I was involved during the last 12 months or so, which bears in several ways on science, religion, and the human experience. The religion in question is primarily the Catholic Church. At this point, I want to say explicitly that I lack any significant expertise in religious studies or theology, and I apologize in advance for misunderstandings and errors on my part. If time permits, I will also try and update you on the two most famous interactions of science and religion. This will be very brief at best, namely the Galileo and Darwin cases. Finally, I apologize that my dentist has become very enthusiastic about me, so that for the time being, my speech is unfortunately not as clear as it should be. This story begins in February of 2000, so it's a little more than a year now. And it starts with a letter that I received from an Italian physicist, Giovanni Bachelet, from which I'd like to read you a few excerpts. Dear Walter, I'm writing you to inquire about your participation to the International Conference, Physics for the 21st Century, to be held in Rome, Italy on September 6, 7, and 8. This conference is part of the celebration for the great jubilee of the Catholic Church, and I was one of the consultants who contributed to the definition of its program. I do not know what your feelings may be about churches, popes, etc. My personal contribution to this program as a church member was the attempt to have top speakers who can give a perspective of science rather than promoting a conference of quote-unquote Catholic scientists. When I received this letter, I reacted to it with mixed feelings. First of all, of course, I think, even though I didn't read the entire letter, it's a short letter, you will see a kind of friendliness and warmth, which I, of course, immediately appreciated very much. However, the idea of attending a conference under the auspices, a scientific conference under the auspices of the Catholic Church, I had very ambivalent feelings about. Not only under the auspices of a church, whatever it was, this question of is that a proper role of any church, but also it was, as the letter explained, part of the jubilee that was proclaimed by Pope John Paul II. The year 2000 was proclaimed as a jubilee year, and I had great problems with that. Of course, we know the meaning of the word jubilee, it's jubilation, and as somebody who has experienced most of the last century, I couldn't really see that it was appropriate for me to participate in a jubilation that century, which had been, in my view, the most spectacular and most golden age of science in the area of human affairs, has quite possibly been the most dismal century. I had some secondary problems. I have been for decades now very much involved in the issues of population and family planning, and I have been and continue to be very unhappy with the role, very powerful role, which the Vatican plays in that area. I also had a problem with the fact that it was, I think, reliably reported that one of the most controversial recent popes, Pope Pius XII, was pope during the Second World War and during the Holocaust, and as far as available records tell us, remained very largely silent during this period about the horrors that occurred, and yet was currently, at that time, a year ago, under consideration for beatification. I thought about this for a few days, and I replied to Giovanni Bachelet that I regret that I will not be coming, and I explained to him, as I did to you, what were my reasons. Now, Giovanni Bachelet wrote back to me, and unfortunately I could not extract a copy of that letter out of my computer. Another very nice letter in which he obviously made it clear to me that he was truly very empathic with my feelings. He told me that he had heard that there would be an unusual statement by the Pope on the sins of the, be careful, it's not sins of the church, sins of sons and daughters of the church during the last 2,000 years, and also that the Pope was going to make a visit to Israel, a historic visit to Israel. Well, again, that was such a warm and friendly letter, and this was new information, so I wrote back and said, thank you very much, and I will wait until I hear about these developments. What then happened, and many of you will know that and remember that, those two events did take place. The statement about the sins was, as Giovanni Bachelet somehow knew in advance, postponed by a week because of difficulties in finding agreement within the Vatican how to formulate it. But it did eventually come out. These were two very remarkable events, this statement about the sins and the visit to Yad Vashem in Israel. And they attracted an enormous amount of attention. And the reaction was mixed. Some emphasized the great positive sides. Some were disappointed by things they had expected and did not find. There was for example, statement of the seven categories of sins. The categories, in case you wonder, are against Christian unity, against the Jews, against respect for love, peace, and cultures, against the dignity of women and minorities, and against human rights. It was a certainly remarkable and completely unprecedented statement, and some people stressed primarily that aspect. Other people said, why was there no mention of any concrete examples? Why was there no mention of the Inquisition? Why was there no mention of the silence of Pius XII during the Holocaust? So the reaction was mixed, and my own reaction was mixed. And I thought about this for quite a while, but I also thought in a very significant part of my thinking was simply the warmth of the communications I'd had from Giovanni Bachelet. And so when I said, well, if I say I've changed my mind, what will that mean? If I say, no, I'm not coming, what will that mean? So finally, with Giovanni Bachelet's in mind, I said, I've changed my mind and I will come. Perhaps I should say a little more about this remarkable statement about the sins of the church. Not the church, excuse me, sons and daughters of the church. This is, sometimes, you know, I feel, gee, must be very difficult to be a Catholic, right? You cannot, or particularly the Pope, the church cannot have made a mistake. That's now a dogma. So So what do you do when the church does make mistakes? Very hard. And I have real sympathy for the Pope. I don't think I could handle that. So here I'm reading various reactions by a rabbi. The Pope ought to talk about the Holocaust. Much concern about the fact that the Pope clearly and very deliberately, and that must have been part of these difficult negotiations within the Vatican, never speaks about any mistakes of the Church itself. So how is one to think about the organized sins like the Inquisition? It's a problem. In any case, I finally decided, okay, I'm going there and see what I can do. And come now to the conference itself. I arrived in Rome, and I will show you a few slides. And so can somebody handle the lights and slides? I do not, from what I see here, I don't believe they are satisfactory. Okay, so that's the announcement. Here you see it was part of a world meeting of university professors. Eventually, I will come to that in a few minutes, there was at the end of all these conferences, there was a meeting within Vatican City in a very large meeting hall where participants in these meetings met and were met by the Pope himself. And there were, I was told by the people from there, about 8,000 people there. So it was representing many, many different disciplines, academic disciplines. Now, I'll come back to that overall picture in a moment, but I'll spend now a few minutes talking about the physics meeting, Physics for the 21st Century, which I participated in. So could I have the next slide? Okay, I want to ask again, can that be read or not? And yes? Okay, great. I'm surprised. Okay, the important list, the more important list, by the way, if you want to admire this wonderful poster better, it is pinned up there. So after the talk, you can look at it. It's really quite beautiful. And particularly for the scientists in the audience, just glance over the list of speakers. And for non-scientists, I will say that it is really an outstanding list. There are among the, I think, 18 speakers, there were 5 Nobel Prize winners. And that's important to mention, it was religiously very diverse. So Giovanni Bachelet was successful in not allowing it to become a conference limited to Catholic scientists. The program had several sessions, covered most of the main branches of physics, cosmology and astrophysics, elementary particles, nuclear physics, and fundamental interactions, atomic and condensed matter physics, and then a round table, I come back to, the physicist's view of the world, and last session, physics and complex systems. That was the program that I got before the meeting actually opened. When the meeting opened, there were various dignitaries here. There was Eileen Nagel, not in person, but her counterpart. The most memorable person for me was, and unusual person for me, was Cardinal Pupar. Cardinal Pupar is one of the major figures within the Vatican. He is the president of the Pontifical Council of Culture. And he gave the opening lecture in Italian. I have a slide, it's rather a nice document, of course few of you can read Italian, I couldn't. But there it is, that is the introduction. Greeting of, I can't read Italian either, but I pretend I can, the Cardinal Paul Pupart, and so on, Physics for the 21st Century. And somewhere hidden down here, now where's this laser pointer? While I work on my documents, can somebody get that going for me? Thank you. Well, it's fine. Okay, yes, it's on. Thank you.
Twist it. Oh, it did work. There it is, right there. There's a button right there.
Oh, button is there. Okay, fine. Thank you. Okay. Excuse me. Somewhere down here, he says that this problematics is particularly important to him because this theme, I can't read this very well here, but on the 31st of October 1992, he was involved with what is described here as the case of Galileo. And I will come back to that. In fact, he was the person who coordinated the work of the Pontifical Council, or Pontifical Academy, in reaching what is the present totally revised attitude of the church towards Galileo. Could I have the slide with the names of the Pontifical Council? Yes, this is a list. I don't know whether it is a cumulative list since this was established a few decades ago, or whether it is actually the present list. It looks a little too big to me to be the present list. But again, I invite the scientists in the audience to run their eyes down this list, and I believe they will agree that it is, again, a very distinguished list, again, a religiously extremely diverse list. I am personally familiar with a whole bunch of these people and have the absolutely highest respect for all of them. Okay. Now, can I see the next slide, please? Okay, put that down again. I come to it in a moment. So this conference proceeded, and when my turn came, I did something that I had previously arranged with Giovanni Bachelet, and he himself had obtained approval for it from the Vatican. And that was that I would give an introduction in which I would explain why I had difficulty making a decision, and that I would also refer to the Holocaust and the fact that there were many influential voices who should have been heard but were not heard. And then I will dedicate my lecture to my former physics teacher, Emil Nohel, who himself was finally a victim of the Holocaust in the last months of the Holocaust, having voluntarily joined his sister in a transport to Auschwitz. I showed this picture and I spoke about him. He was an extraordinary teacher, and certainly without him I would not be standing here. This introduction was very warmly received by the audience. The meeting itself I would rate, compared to the meetings, many meetings that I attend, as an excellent meeting. Not perhaps the very best, but it was excellent. An interesting feature was a round table discussion, about which I don't really remember too much. The person who was nominally in charge of it, it will be known to the physicists here, namely David Merman. And another interesting participant was an archbishop, Zichinski, a Polish archbishop, who I was told had a PhD in theoretical physics, and participated as an archbishop and spoke about science and faith. That has been a theme discussed in the Vatican extensively and written about very extensively in recent years. In Latin, it is not science and faith, but fides et ratio. Notice the order is inverted. At the end of the meeting, a Russian journalist came up to me and said, do I approve this kind of religious supervision of science? And that was actually the first moment that I specifically had asked myself that question, and I said, no, I do not. I do not because in this group and in any scientific meeting, you are likely to find people who are, first of all, certainly do not belong to any particular religion, such as this in this case, and others who are agnostics and who are atheists and who are perfectly fine scientists, and the ones that I know are perfectly fine human beings, and I did not think it was appropriate to have them put under the aegis of religion, let alone a particular religion. On the other hand, I also said to her that I very much like the idea of meetings devoted to the purpose of discussing science and religion. As Eileen said, those are the two great forces in society nowadays. And this meeting is an example of the kind that I had in mind. Yes, I approve that. But in thinking back of that particular meeting, it was that theological presence was not comfortable for me. After that meeting ended, we were invited, I'm leaving out social events, some of which were absolutely on an absolutely grand scale, all that through the connections of the Vatican. One of the main reception was in a palace of the kind that I've never been in before, where paintings were stacked The walls were totally covered with paintings which were stacked four or five high, and these were large paintings. but the coming back to the more serious part, our meeting ended. When our meeting ended, all the meetings had ended, and so there was now this meeting in the Vatican. Let's see, I think I have, there's the Vatican. The hall where this was held is a fairly modern hall. I believe it is what you see there on the very left, something like a big bending concrete roof, and that holds this large number of people. We all had badges of various kinds and were carefully ushered into our seats. The whole thing was extremely well organized. And the theme of this entire set of activities was the University for a New Humanism. Now, the meeting itself with the Vatican, in the Vatican, took about 3 or 4 hours the morning. It started with music and liturgy. There were general philosophical reports in many different languages from many different parts of the world. There were different areas of scholarship that were reported on, for example, the natural sciences, or another area was called the city of man. Another area was called the human person. Another area was called arts and music. Now, I have here, brought here something with me that I'd like to consult and read you from about science. All right, I cannot at the moment put my hands on it, so I'll just tell you about it. It was, that particular report was given by a Croat by the name of Sunčić, whose work I happen to have read some decades ago, a very fine physicist, and clearly a very devout Catholic. And he reported this work in the spirit of this meeting, which was, as I mentioned, the University for a New Humanism. this was eventually, after perhaps 1 or 2 hours, or I should perhaps mention, there was a very interesting woman, an African woman, who somehow had been substituted at the last moment. And as far as I could understand what she said, she was not very happy about being such a substitute, and she said so. now, you have in the handout, you have then the address of the Holy Father. And at this point, I should perhaps go back a little bit and say that very early in the proceedings, the Pope entered from the side, visualize a very large, wide stage, in the center of which was a simple chair or throne for the Pope. He entered, I found my throat tightening. It was extremely moving, because here was this old gentleman. Actually, he is not that much different age than I, but fortunately, I have not had this terrible experience that you know about, namely this assassination attempt on the Pope, from which it appears he's never really fully recovered. Nevertheless, he had difficulty. He has a little Parkinson's disease. He had difficulty lifting his feet, but he strolled with a large Pope's staff, simple wooden staff, strolled in, long steps, and with two cardinals on each side, and sat down, blessed the crowd as he moved across the stage. Now it was time for, then came these reports, which were given to him, and then came his own speech, of which you have a copy. I invite you, perhaps not while I'm speaking, to read it. I consider it to be a very fine speech. After this speech, some of us, we'd all been shown our seats. I'd been shown a seat in the front row, and I began to see that the ushers were doing things, and the people in the front row were moving towards the center, and then up some steps to meet the Pope himself. many of you know there is a protocol for that, and the normal protocol is that you kneel down and you kiss the ring of the Pope. this was something that I knew I could not do, but I also wanted to make sure that I didn't cause any bad feelings. At that point, fortunately, the Archbishop that had been at the meeting and who was walking around, this is a huge place, and there were people in different shades of red, cardinals, Archbishop, meandering around. He meandered towards me, and he said, you know, if you feel like it, please go up, and you know, if you want to, you can say a few words, and you certainly don't need to kneel down or kiss the Pope's ring. That's not necessary at all. Okay, so while we were sort of moving over, right, I had time to think about what I might say. did eventually reach the Pope, and let's see, Mary, I think we have a picture. Yes. Now, I thought about various things I might say, and I had very much in mind the remarkable things that the Pope had done in the previous months that I've mentioned to you, the statement about the sins of the sons and daughters of the Church and his visit to Yad Vashem, where he said some wonderful things. And so I finally, what I said to him was, I said, Your Holiness, I thank you deeply for the courageous steps you have undertaken to improve the mutual understanding between Christians and Jews. And he said, thank you, but I wasn't quite finished. After all, I had prepared this carefully. And I finished by saying, and I entreat you to continue further along this path. And he said, thank you very much. So that was my encounter with the Pope, and it was an unforgettable experience. The Pope himself, just to convey to you a little bit the sort of personal impression one I had at this moment. You notice, by the way, I had broken my wrist. You see something black. I told my surgeon later on that the Pope had shaken his splint. But you notice the Pope held my hand in a really very warm enclosure, you might say, and has these sparkling bright eyes. It was a wonderful encounter, personal encounter. And you see, I can't see the shade of red, but behind there is either a cardinal or an archbishop. All right. I see where I am. Pardon? I'm sorry, I can't really understand what you're saying. This was on a Saturday. On a Sunday, there was, as the final end, there was a Holy Mass, which I did not attend. I left on Saturday. I went, came home via Frankfurt. In Frankfurt, I stopped, picked up some newspapers, and I became aware that while this conference was going on, a very important document had been issued by the Vatican, whose title is Dominus Jesus, whose author is Cardinal Ratzinger, prefect of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. This is the direct successor of the Inquisition. I read the newspaper account, and it upset me very much. I have since read the entire document, and it confirmed my original impression. I should perhaps say, Eileen sort of alluded to it, that partly because of my experience during the war years and pre-war years in Europe, I have become very sensitive to a certain situation, a situation where something is done that does not seem to be a good thing, and many people are aware of it but ignore it. And that, of course, was a tragedy during the Holocaust. And I have, on several occasions, said to myself, that's something that I should not do. I found this statement extraordinarily intolerant. Intolerant not only of other religions, but or other non-Christian faiths, which were described as having grave defects, but very intolerant even of non-Catholic Christian religions. I read it and said, my goodness, you know, this is really a shock. And maybe I can think of something that I personally can do about it. Of course, I have no illusions of grandeur, but I do think that it's not a good excuse. And many people in Germany and Austria use that excuse. Well, what can I do? There is this big machinery out there, and so I can't do anything, so I better do something else. When I came home, I began to think that maybe with my new friend Giovanni Bachelet and with the help of the Archbishop, who had been so kind to me, I might be able to perhaps write a letter to the Pope and actually have it reach the Pope. Giovanni Bachelet has an abbreviation, I don't know, it's an Italian abbreviation, and it refers to the waste paper basket of the Vatican. So he said, well, let's hope that this doesn't read this, whatever, ABC. I did put such a letter together. It took me several months. I had a wonderful help. I will acknowledge that later. I sent that letter to Giovanni Bachelet, who sent it further to the Archbishop. And the Archbishop sent it to the Secretary of State of the Vatican with his own request that it be presented to the Pope. And you have in your handout, you have the acknowledgement by the office of the Secretary of State, an acknowledgement that I was absolutely thrilled by because it was extremely friendly and had an extremely open-minded tone. And explicitly said that the Pope has read your letter. It was a 3-page single-spaced letter. now, there is, Mary, where is that Gaudium and Spes quotation? Where does that appear? The Gaudium and Spes, do we have it somewhere? It's not in the handout. Okay, well, I will then just describe it to you. Giovanni Bachelet, in one of his letters to me, sent me also, himself was at least as upset as I by the Ratzinger statement, Dominus Jesus, probably more upset. It affects him more directly. And then sent me an absolutely wonderful quote. We'll see whether maybe in the next little while we can still find it. From Vatican II on the same subject, which is just totally generous towards everybody as far as the possibility of, as far as the possibility of salvation is concerned. The Ratzinger document says, and leaves no doubt about the interpretation, it says it 3 or 4 times, the only church through which one can go to heaven, through which one can be saved, is the Catholic Church. Now, other churches that are very, very near it can, through their nearness to the Catholic Church, also partially offer salvation. Protestants, absolutely not. And non-Christian religions, absolutely, absolutely not. Thank you. Thanks very much. Okay. Yes. So I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself. In my letter, a little later, to the Archbishop, I write, may I invite you to compare the exclusionary tone of Dominus Jesus with the following radiantly generous excerpt concerning salvation from Gaudium et Spes, Vatican Council II, 1965, kindly provided me by my good friend, Professor Giovanni Bachelet. And then I quote from Vatican Council II, all this holds true not only for Christians, but for the speaking of salvation, but for all men of good will, in whose hearts grace works in an unseen way, since the ultimate vocation of man is in fact one and divine, we ought to believe that the Holy Spirit, in a manner known only to God, offers to every man the possibility of being associated with this Paschal mystery. So, that is the end of the story about my letter to the Pope. I did send it, as I mentioned to you, through the Archbishop, the Polish Archbishop, and he decided to write me, and you have that in your, you have his letter to me. And he writes to me, again, in an extremely friendly way. And he does not argue. I had written him a lengthy letter saying, he had read my letter to the Pope in which I expressed my dismay about the Ratzinger document. And he replies to this, the Archbishop, in terms of an analogy with physics. I appreciated that letter very much. I don't agree with it, and I replied to him at some length, but in hopefully the same friendly spirit as his own letter. So that is really the story of my encounter with the Pope and what was connected with it, including my own thoughts and other people's thoughts and actions. And now I have a quick question. We are late. Shall I take 5 minutes? Where's the chairman? Yes. Shall I take 5 minutes to just summarize, and that's good news, where the Galileo and the evolution story stands? Okay? Fine. So, the Galileo story reached its most recent point in October of 1992, so it's really very recent. And my young friend, about whom I'll speak in a moment, provided me with the following excerpt from the Los Angeles Times of October 31, 1992. Vatican admits Galileo correct. Vatican City, I can't help it, it's LA Times lingo. It's official, the earth revolves around the sun. Even for the Vatican. All right. Now, to go back, I have the statement of the Pope on this, and I found it, all in all, an outstanding statement. It has 15 sections or more, and I will read now for very few minutes. Here is quoting the Pope on Galileo. From the Galileo affair, we can learn the lesson which remains valid in relation to similar situations which occur today and which may occur in the future. In Galileo's time, to depict the world as lacking an absolute physical reference point was, so to speak, inconceivable. And since the cosmos, as it was then known, was contained within the solar system alone, this reference point could only be situated in the Earth or in the Sun. Today, after Einstein, and within the perspective of contemporary cosmology, neither of these two reference points has the importance they once had. This is for just the graduate level physicists, because from the point of view of Einstein's general relativity theory, there is no preferred center in the cosmos. So this is, on the one hand, a very sophisticated statement, another aside to the physicists here, but on the other hand, it's a bit misleading, right? We all know why. Okay. Listen to this generosity of the Pope's language. This observation, it goes without saying, is not directed against the validity of Galileo's position in the debate. It is only meant to show that often beyond two partial and contrasting perceptions, there exists a wider perception which includes them and goes beyond both of them. and skipping some lines, the era of the theologians of the time, when they maintained the centrality of the earth, was to think that our understanding of the physical world structure was in some way imposed by the literal sense of sacred scripture. And then he quotes something in Latin. I checked it. I like Latin, but don't know too much about it. I checked it out with Professor Dunn in Classics, and he also had trouble with it. The best we could come up with is translation, and it's a kind of a good statement, namely that faith teaches how to get to heaven, not how heaven moves. Further down, again, Einstein is being quoted. It is a statement which was prepared under the coordination of this Cardinal Pupart, who opened our conference and who is the head of the Pontifical Council for Culture, by this distinguished group of people who constitute the Academy, Vatican Academy of Sciences. So there we are on Galileo, and I think everybody can feel better about it. On evolution, very briefly, the first important step was taken by Pius XII, whom I've mentioned in other contexts before. In 1950, and this is an excerpt from his writings, some imprudently and indiscreetly hold that evolution explains the origin of all things. Communists gladly subscribe to this opinion, so that when the souls of men have been deprived of every idea of a personal God, they may the more efficaciously defend and propagate their dialectic materialism. This pope, as the present pope, has had this tremendous hatred for communism. So on, you know, on the issue of evolution, that this is centered on the issue of dialectic materialism is remarkable. But continuing, you will see there is now a considerable flexibility. Still Pius XII, the teaching authority of the Church does not forbid that in conformity with the present state of human sciences and sacred theology, research and discussions on the part of men experienced in both fields take place with regard to the doctrine of evolution, in as far as it inquires into the origin of the human body as coming from pre-existent and living matter. For the Catholic faith obliges us to hold that souls are immediately created by God. So this is a position that no problems with research into evolution, scientific research into evolution, but the Catholic faith, I'm reading again, obliges us to hold that souls are immediately created by God. And essentially, that is the position today. It was reaffirmed but strengthened in a statement by the present Pope. The present Pope first quotes Pope Pius XII, and says, Pope Pius XII added that this opinion of evolution should not be adopted as though it were a certain proven doctrine. And now this pope speaking. Today, almost half a century after the publication of that paper, new knowledge has led to the recognition of the theory of evolution as more than a hypothesis. It is indeed remarkable that this theory has been progressively accepted by researchers following a series of discoveries in various fields of knowledge. This convergence, neither sought nor fabricated, of the results of work that was conducted independently is in itself a significant argument in favor of the theory. So it is an endorsement of the original position, but says today there's been so, in those 50 years, there's been so much additional corroboration, scientific corroboration, that the theory, always with the proviso that man has a soul, is entirely acceptable to the Catholic Church. There is, of course, something that might be added about Kansas City and so on, but I've taken enough of your time. So before I close, I do want to say a few words of thanks, a few personal words, and I will definitely be much shorter than Jim. First of all, Giovanni Bachelet. Well, perhaps the most important outcome of all this, personal outcome for me, has been that we've become just very, very good friends. I mean, a few people with whom I can communicate in kind of a better spirit and much fun and understanding as with Giovanni Bachelet. So it's really something wonderful. I want to thank very much Vince Biondo, who I think is sitting back there. Perhaps you just stand up for a second. A young man who is studying religious studies here and has very generously offered to do much of the library and web research on which this talk was based. So thank you very much, Vince. And I'd like to thank Mary Hicks, who has a harder time getting up because she's on the floor, who is my secretary and who's been absolutely, for the last, I don't know, 3 months or so, been involved in preparing this lecture. Thank you very much.
By way of quick anecdotes, you can tell why our faculty committee asked Walter to be the inaugural lecturer. This is a story only you could have told. I must say he was a little reluctant at the first, and it took some gentle arm twisting, but I was successful, and I'm very happy for all of us that he agreed. Thank you so much, Walter. Walter, you may or may not be surprised to know that fully two-thirds of people in this room can be found outside of this room, sitting in the halls, listening to this lecture. And to those who are sitting outside and listening to the audio feed, as well as those inside the room who are sitting uncomfortably, we again promise to you to offer a video screening of Walter's lecture at a time in the immediate near future. We also promise that we have learned, and though the venues are secured for this spring, we have 2 further years of research lectures. We have learned that this is a popular topic, and we promise to provide a chair for everyone to sit upon in future. I would now like to welcome Rabbi Stephen Cohen and Professor Jim Langer of Department of Physics, who will offer brief comments on Walter's talk. Following that, we will have a general question and answer session before the general reception.
Hi, I'm Jim Langer. I'm not the rabbi. Also, as far as introduction, you noticed what at one point Walter said, that you're really supposed to listen to him and not read the Pope's speech, and he was looking right at me. And of course, I was trying to figure out whether I'm supposed to respond to Walter or the Pope. The rules of the game, of course, are that I'm not supposed to have prepared very much to say because I'm supposed to respond. And of course, the rules of the game are that as an old student of Walter's, I'm not supposed to contradict him, and I wouldn't. I did think, though, that it might be appropriate just to think for a couple of minutes about, you know, what the implications are of the kinds of things that Walter is telling us about for the rest of this series, for the kinds of discussions that are going to go on with this series of lectures and discussions supported by the Templeton Foundation. And of course, one of the reasons that Jim asked me to do this is he knows that I'm about as skeptical as a person who's really interested in the subject can be, because I'm not really quite clear where we want to go in this series, although I'm obviously completely convinced that we are dealing with some of the most important issues facing our society in the 21st century. The issues of how we understand the relationships between science on the one hand, which is clearly going to mold so much of what happens to us and what we do, and religion on the other hand, or perhaps, and I would much prefer to say, the humanistic approach to many, many questions that we talk about. Now, it's absolutely clear to me, and I think to Walter, I don't think I'm contradicting him, that the title of that session, that it was Faith and Reason, are talking about two really antithetical concepts. You know, we can talk about faith, certainly in the religious sense, as being, you know, an unreasoned belief in whatever, in certain theologies, in certain legends, in certain principles, if you like, because those principles have been enunciated in books and in literature and tenets that have come down to us through the ages. We can also talk about science in something like the same way, the same language, you know, an unreasonable belief that all questions can be answered by logical consideration. And that too, scientists have to learn, is not a reasonable point of view. We know perfectly well that there are many, many questions that simply do not have answers, that have ethical aspects to them, that we must struggle with, and we might eventually find some kinds of compromises. So, although I personally would rather prefer that these discussions not have to be, like Walter, not have to take place within between, you know, scientists and organized religions, I find myself these days increasingly skeptical about the lesson, for example, the words that were used by the Pope, even in a speech that Walter was quoting. I certainly am eager that these discussions should take place. But I think that the first kinds of things that we have to do if we're going to make these discussions sensible is that we have to learn how to talk with each other using words that mean the same things, you know, to both of us, that we somehow have to think about, you know, where are the areas of common ground? How can we discuss with each other, either making the same assumptions or at least understanding clearly that we're making different assumptions when we talk, that we're using words in different ways, and perhaps we're trying to make those words a bit more precise so that we really do understand what each of us is trying to say. And I think, you know, above all, in discussions of this kind, and again, I believe I detect this theme in Walter's words, that we somehow, all of us, have to be very honest with ourselves. We have to not try to paper over certain differences of opinions, certain differences in beliefs, that we have to bring them to the surface, that we have to understand what those differences are. We have to understand exactly where we disagree with each other. And perhaps in that way, you know, we can make progress in the discussions that this series is going to provide the opportunity for us to participate in. I think that's as much as I need to say, Jim. All right.
I'm not the physics professor. I'm Steve Cohen. I think what I'd like to direct my comments to is the analogy that the Archbishop makes in his letter between different religious theories or different religious systems and different scientific systems, because I think that that really touches on, you know, one of the interesting questions of this series, which is how similar and how different are religious and scientific ways of thinking and of exploring. I don't know, is it worth putting it up on the slide again, this letter from the Archbishop, in which he says, "Your problems with the document, Dominus Jesus, can be compared to the process of scientific growth approached in diachronic perspective." You see that at the beginning of that third paragraph. This really is fascinating because it really touches on the problematic point in Jewish and Catholic relations, or Jewish and Christian relations. The thing that the Jews want from the church in general is some kind of a pulling back from the old classical Christian idea of Christianity being progress over or beyond Judaism. You know, that was essentially the premise of Christianity for almost 2,000 years, that Christianity represented an advance over Judaism. And Jews understood that about Christianity and didn't like that interpretation of the relationship between the two religions. And the way that I read this, and I am not the physics professor, I have no idea what Einstein-Cartan modification of G.R. Kaluza's theories, superstring theories is the one that I've heard of but don't know anything about, M theory, I don't know what these are, but what I glean from this, and perhaps some of you read the letter differently, is that the Archbishop is suggesting that just as there is scientific progress and one theory comes along and adds to and carries us forward beyond the old theory, so too a religion can come along and add to and carry us beyond another religion. And so, at least as I read this letter, and I don't know, Walter, if you read it the same way, I don't know about those of you, but I, you know, that's the way that I read this letter, is that it's essentially what is called in this discussion replacement theology, that Christianity replaces Judaism. And what we Jews would prefer is a more Jewish view of things, which is really epitomized in, I'll give you an old and a new statement of our idea. There is in the Talmud, the Talmud, our big Jewish book, series of books, is full of arguments, full of disputes. One rabbi says this, the other rabbi says this. They're arguing with each other. And the question, and actually the two great schools of thought are, the house of Hillel and the house of Shammai. And at one point, the question is asked, since the house of Hillel says this and the house of Shammai says the exact opposite, how do we know which are the words of God? And the answer is, these and these are the words of the living God. And that teaching really captures in one line the Jewish notion of God. And I think it's very similar to a statement that I believe is attributed to Niels Bohr, who somebody here must know it better than I do, but I loved it the first time I heard it. The statement is, and I believe it was Niels Bohr, that the opposite of a fact is usually a falsehood, but the opposite of a great truth is very often another great truth. That's the Jewish angle. You know, that's the way that we think about it, that you can have conflicting truths that are both true, that are both the words of the living God. And that's what we Jews would love to hear someday from the Pope. So, thank you.
Thank you very much, both Jim and Steve. We are now, I'd like actually to invite you and Walter, if you could, to please come up and take a seat up in front. We are now going to have, we are running over in time, but we'll have a brief question and answer session. I'd like to remind you that this is being televised for UCTV, and so somewhere we have two people who will be running wireless microphones around, also in the back. So you will raise your hand and please use the microphone for the questions, who can be addressed to Dr. Cohn or either of the discussants. Please state your question in the form of a question. Enough said. Questions.
I have a question for Dr. Langer. Is it scientifically correct to call the moment of the Big Bang of the universe a creation event? Thank you.
Well, the question was, is it scientifically correct to call the moment of the Big Bang a creation event? And I have two questions about that question. I mean, one is if it's a creation event, do you mean to imply that there was a creator? And of course, the scientific point of view, I think, is it's best to say is has nothing to say about that particular aspect of the issue. The other interpretation of it that you might mean is, you know, was this really the beginning of things? And my own sense of this is that we really don't know, probably not. We don't really know what time means when we're talking about things like that. There are many other theories that say, well, that was just a certain quantum fluctuation that occurs in a whole lot of, and the universe is, you know, much frothier than that. There are all sorts of things. And what's really wonderful about that whole question, though, is that we are probably on the verge of not necessarily finding a for sure answer, but learning one hell of a lot more. Oh, I shouldn't say that. a large amount more about this, you know, really within our lifetimes, and discovering a lot of just beautiful things about the origin of the universe.
Thank you.
I have a question about sort of standards of truth, that one of the big differences between science and religion, I think of, is in terms of standard of truth. When do you accept something as true? How do you decide whether something is true or not? I know that often science and religion deal with very different questions, but sometimes they deal with similar questions. So how do you reconcile the fact that when these two approaches have very different standards of truth, do these different fields have things they could learn from each other? Should one learn from the other? How do you reconcile these particular aspects?
Would you like anyone in particular to answer? Okay.
I'd like to ask you to just give a specific example. It's a hard enough question, and it will become a little easier if we can focus on a particular case that you have in mind.
Okay, well, for instance, there's one of the things I think of in Christianity is the sense of a historical truth, that Jesus was not a metaphorical figure, he was a real person, he was crucified, he arrived 3 days later, was resurrected 3 days later. So these are questions of historical truth, according to the Catholic Church. On the same time with history, we have questions of what is the historical record, what is the historical evidence for something, how do we decide whether something is true or not. So in this case, there are two ways of thinking about a common event and a common hypothesis or statement.
Well, first, if I understand the significance of your question, it deals with, I think you used the expression historically truth, which is somewhat different from a scientific truth. But I'm unclear about what you are saying. I think the question whether these events took place in history is not yet historically established. Now, in Christian theology, they are the answer that these events did take place are articles of faith. So I don't really see this example as demonstrating the conflict between science and religion.
This question is addressed to Mr. Cohn. I can't resist saying, needless to say, you're a hero and a true inspiration. I was struck particularly by your description of your relations with your friend Giovanni and the Archbishop.
Could the person who's speaking stand up so I can see? Yes, thank you.
I was struck particularly by your description of your dealings with Giovanni and the Archbishop, how they seem to be characterized by a language of peace and of respect. And I was wondering if you thought that kind of trend would continue to grow both in academic circles and the dealings between nations and on a smaller level between families and communities. Especially also you mentioned the Dalai Lama. Will this kind of interaction contribute to solutions to such problems that we have in Tibet and other situations around the world?
I have a very concrete recent basis for optimism. It's not as far-reaching as you are asking about, but I have just recently read in the newspaper about a heresy trial that has come to its end under the same Cardinal Ratzinger. The heresy trial, the person being tried was himself a member of the Society of Jesus, a professor in a Catholic university in Rome, whose name is Jacques Dupuy, of Belgian origin. He has written a book which I have looked through. It's 400 pages. I have not yet read it completely, and it's hard reading. and you need the complete Oxford Dictionary. We have the short Oxford Dictionary, and it's not sufficient. In any case, I found this man very interesting, and I wonder what Steve Cohen and Jim Langer, how they would react. So let me explain. The title is already interesting. Oh, I first have to tell you the outcome of the heresy trial. He was not found to be a heretic, but he was found, he was severely criticized for his views and for his writings, which were said to, while not quite drifting into the area of heresy, are so close that they would certainly be misunderstood and misinterpreted by many readers. And in what I looks to me like a piece of Vatican plea bargaining, he, as I said, was not convicted of heresy. Can you believe that such things actually still occur, heresy trials? But had to agree that he will include the criticism of the commission as an appendix in future editions of his book. Reminiscent of Galileo, right? So it's not quite over. Now, what does this man say? The title of his book is Towards a Christian Theology of Religious Pluralism. And I feel extremely close to this man from a Jewish standpoint. Namely, he speaks, first of all, with complete respect of other religions. Secondly, he supports the idea of religious pluralism rather than an idea that many of us have had at various times, or perhaps still have, that wouldn't it be nice if all religions would be exactly the same? He says, no, it's much better to have religious pluralism, but with respect towards from one religion towards the others. It's a 400-page book. I've highlighted here to show you the difference between that point of view and the Cardinal Ratzinger point of view. So quoting a couple of lines, one can say in all certainty that by the dialogue, Christians and others walk together towards truth. Ratzinger, by the way, very honest man, brilliant man, explains the purpose of Catholic dialogue, and the only purpose of Catholic dialogue is conversion. The position of the Church is repeatedly and unmistakably stated as being final, unchangeable, and true. And here you see a person who says, by dialogue, Christian and others can walk together towards truth. In case there are some people from the religion department here, there used to be a wonderful gentleman for many years, Panikkar. Anybody here remembers him? Very interesting man, a chemist by undergraduate education, I think. If my recollection is correct, he was half Indian and half Spanish, and he was a Catholic. And he was a truly very broad man, and I'm delighted to see him quoted here. So I'll read a paragraph or so. This is from the same book of Dupuy. Raymond, Panikkar's focus is somewhat different. He insists that the various religious traditions differ and must keep their distinct identity. He rejects as facile eclecticism, which would destroy the respective identities. Faith cannot be bracketed, and then that is to clarify it, it's translated into Greek, but I'll spare you that, to ease the dialogue. But now this I put together with a short English dictionary. The cosmotheandric mystery, the object of faith, is common to all religious traditions. Beliefs differ in each. Cosmotheandric, three roots, cosmos, theos, and andros. the world, God, and man. and he speaks about, says, between these beliefs, Panikkar advocates a cross-fertilization, which he terms syncretism, in view of a mutual enrichment. So to come back to the question, would the gentleman stand up again? Yeah, so, you know, the fact, now this book has been a Catholic bestseller in the United States. I have incredible reviews. It is in second printing. I see a review from Franz Cardinal Koenig. He's the 90-plus-year-old Catholic cardinal in Austria, whom I had occasion to talk with on a couple of occasions, and for whom I have enormous respect, who says, I've been fascinated by Father Jacques Dupuy's latest masterly work. In tackling this exceedingly different terrain, Dupuy is trying to steer a course in close conjunction with the Church and with papal documents as his basic orientation. So you can see that while on the one hand, this man was tried over a period of 2 or 3 years for heresy and eventually barely exculpated. On the other hand, Cardinal Koenig, who's by far the most respected cardinal in Austria, is very sympathetic to it. So I think, be interested in Steve's ideas. To me, this is my vision of independent religions, but religions that are fully respectful of each other, rather than this notion all religions, after all, are exactly the same, which is not the case. It occurred to me actually today while I was looking over my notes. Think of an analogy of a spectrum of colors, and what do they look like in twilight? They all become gray. The spectrum of colors is a richer world.
Steve, would you like to comment on that at all?
Thanks, Walter. I think I'd like to respond. I'd like to respond with a question, and it perhaps goes back to Jim's comments from the podium, which is, for me personally, it's not difficult to feel sympathy for the vision that you're describing, Walter, of a rich world of many religious traditions. Each of which is confident and clear about its identity and has an integrity, but which is able to live confidently and securely side by side with other religious traditions. A question that comes to mind for me, and I think it's at the heart of where this series needs to go, is are scientific worldviews, to use a term loosely, in some way analogous to religious traditions? And do they need to live side by side also, or is it really talking about something completely different, which should not be seen as being analogous and in any way parallel? Or
I'll just comment very briefly on that. I did reply to the Archbishop at length. I did not present this here. By the way, I have it available for anybody who would like to see it. And I question precisely that analogy and say that, yes, I mean, compare, and this is following his text, compare Newton and Einstein, and I think the implication is clear that this is the analogy between, let's say, Judaism and Christianity. And I say, well, of course, Newton and Einstein, in science, we have well-defined, clear criteria to say which is the better theory. It's a theory that explains experimental observations more effectively. And if there's a clear difference, as there is between Newton and Einstein, in the domain of small particles, high velocities, and so on, there's no question, right? Einstein is the more advanced theory. But I say there is no such test in the case of religions. You cannot make similar tests in the case of religions. So I very politely, more politely than my words now, do not accept that analogy.
We will take one final question, which is in the back.
Hi, my name is Jose. Last semester, quarter, I wrote an essay on a medieval mind trying to reconcile faith and reason. And one of you brought that up, saying that they're two opposite truths. Somebody, or I don't know if it was the same person, said that Christianity and Judaism are two opposing truths that they're both right. And so I was wondering, I was going to ask one of the physicists if this is what this series of conferences, is it going to attempt to answer, to explore the one truth, I guess, that is achieved both by faith and by reason and science?
That sounds more like a question to Jim Proctor.
Well, wait and see.
Can I just quote from memory something in, I believe it is in one of the Pope's, present Pope's sayings, where he has at least a very beautiful image, namely of faith and reason being two independent wings aspiring to the same truth. I think there is some real substance to this image. There is an important body of opinion that is looking for a complete identification of faith and reason. That, so to speak, when in the distant future, when more and more progress has been made, faith and reason will be found to be the same. And the image here is, no, that is not the same. They are two independent wings. And my own belief, for what it's worth, is that that is the better image.
I'd like to offer my profound thanks to Dr. Cohn and everyone who has participated today. Thank you so much for coming. And I have one question. The one question is, when does it rain in Santa Barbara? The answer is, whenever the Templeton Foundation visits. And I would like to ask our scientists and religious leaders to try and explain that. Because of this, the reception right now will be held in the lounge down and to the left. No, it does not quite accommodate 150 people, but we will try. Thank you very much. Remember, our next lecture is 1 week from now, Jeffrey Russell.